From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Barry Schwartz is a professor of psychology and social theory, but in a lot of ways, he's a philosopher. He's devoted his career to looking at how we live, but also how we serve our souls, and lately he's been looking at the workplace. He says the workplace needs a radical overhaul to make workers happier and companies more profitable. So what are we waiting for? This hour On Point, Labor Day, building a better workplace. You can join us on air or online. Is your office, your factory, the classic grind? Or do you work at a place where your work, your effort is satisfying and appreciated? Do you think we can really change the way we work? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Philadelphia is Barry Schwartz, professor of social theory and social action at Swarthmore College. He got a lot of attention for his previous books and TED Talks on the paradox of choice and practical wisdom. His new book is called Why We Work. He's given a TED Talk about it, which goes live online tomorrow. If you go to our website, onpointradio.org, you'll find links to an excerpt of his new book and to his TED Talks. Barry Schwartz, great to have you with us today.
Hi, Jane. It's great to be with you.
So in the book, you say that we've long been taught that the reason we work is primarily for a paycheck. What did your research show? The bigger the paycheck, the better?
Well, I mean, of course, the bigger the paycheck, the better. But the mistake, or at least what I regard as a mistake, is, and it began 200 years ago, is the assumption that since people work for pay, and there's no denying that we do, they work only for pay. So that if you get the pay right, nothing else matters. And what I try to suggest in the book is that that's simply not true.
So take us back 200 years then. Chapter one of your book is called The False Rationale, and lay out some of the assumptions about human nature that are baked into the labor economy and where those ideas came from.
Well, the key assumption, or at least the one that I start things with, is with Adam Smith, because he's essentially the father of the modern market. And his assumption was that basically people would rather do nothing than something, would like to live life at their ease. So if you want to get people to do things, you have to make it worth their while. And that meant you had to pay them. And the more you paid them, the harder the more they would work, and the harder they would work, and perhaps the better they would work. So I think the seeds of this view began there. What happened over time as the factory system evolved is that people came to think that nothing else mattered. So there was a movement 100 years after Adam Smith called the scientific management movement, where factory work was engineered so that you could get maximum output with minimum effort, minimum motion of the body, and minimum training. Again, with the assumption that if you simply make people cogs in the machine, that it'll work fine as long as you pay them right.
Mm.
And I think it's sort of been that way more or less ever since.
So the Industrial Revolution and time management and the assembly line created new efficiencies and wealth for many people, but it also brought less satisfaction at work, or at least in some people's minds.
That's right, or at least less engagement. You know, I don't know totally what everyone thinks the word satisfaction means, but people were less engaged by their work. And the point I make in the book is a Gallup poll from 2013 that showed that 13% of people worldwide said they were engaged by their work,
13%. So that means shy 90% of adults spend half their waking lives doing things they would rather not do. I think this is what you said in the book.
Yes.
At places they would rather not be.
That's correct. Now, most of them are not disengaged. Most of them are simply unengaged. And one way of understanding that, and it's hard to get into the heads of people, is, you know, they go to work and they're unengaged, but their expectations about what's possible in work have really been so downgraded by the nature of the workplace that as long as they have a decent work environment and a nice paycheck and some job security and benefits, that's all that matters. So, you know, you're not supposed to be engaged by your work. You work to take care of your family.
Is that what you mean when you say in the book that many of us are defeated by our work?
That's what I mean. I think you know, people have kind of lost the aspiration, not everybody, but people have lost the aspiration that work can actually be a really meaningful, significant part of your life that so, you actually in, you know, you look forward to doing your work instead of sort of grudgingly trudging off to the workplace 5 days a week.
So talk about that disengagement more, that unengagement, as you say. You, in this book, take us through hospitals and hair salons and boardrooms and auto plants and research workers from all walks of life.
That's right.
What tends to create this disengagement?
Well, it's easier, I think, if I tell you what I think creates the engagement.
Okay.
And then if you just imagine a workplace that doesn't have these things.
Okay.
And,
all right. What
I suggest in the book, based on evidence, is that people want to feel a certain amount of autonomy and discretion. They want to be, to some degree, in charge of what they do. They want to be respected by the people who supervise them and trusted to use their judgment. They want to develop on mm-hmm. their jobs. They want to learn new stuff. And what I think is most important, they want the sense that what they do is meaningful, which to me largely means that what they do actually makes a positive difference in the lives of other people, even a small one.
So you can talk about autonomy and discretion, being respected by supervisors and having a higher purpose at work. But frankly, a lot of people these days are just trying to get by. And I want to play some sound here. This is April 15th of this year. Low wage workers across the country rallying for higher minimum wages. In July, they had a taste of victory in New York, at least, when a wage board created by Governor Andrew Cuomo ruled that fast food workers should earn $15 an hour. Here's a protester in New York City, Mark Lester. This is back in April.
The minimum wage is too low. In New York State, it's $8.75, and we want $15 federal, nationwide. All right? People got minimum wage jobs, raising families. This is social injustice, people.
So there's the minimum wage. Today, President Obama here in Boston announcing an executive order he'll sign on Monday requiring U.S. government contractors to offer 7 days of paid sick leave for their workers. You got a lot of moves here. Are they in the right direction? Are these steps forward, or we're not really addressing the core problem?
Well, no, they're certainly steps forward. I think people need to be adequately compensated, and I think the current minimum wage is a complete disgrace. People work – people need to earn a living, and it seems to me self-evident that there shouldn't be any jobs that if people do them doesn't succeed in earning them a living. So I don't think that that's an issue. What I would say is that maybe because it's become so dire, the wages that low-wage workers make, it's become the only thing on the table. You know, give me enough to live on. Give me health care. Give me regular hours so that I can arrange my child care in advance. All of those are perfectly legitimate demands. But those are not the only demands that matter. And what you could imagine is if some of these demands actually start to get met, then maybe people will turn their attention to the character of the work they do in addition to the compensation.
Hmm. You say in the book, quote, the root of what drives us to do good work can rarely be incentivized. What do you mean by that?
There's a lot of research on this. You know, imagine – let's take a concrete example. You know, you want teachers to teach better. So you introduce all kinds of incentives, bonuses, promotions and stuff like that to get teachers to do a better job with their students. And what ends up happening is either they teach to the test – which we well know does not produce better learning. It just produces higher test scores. Or, as has been the case in a few places, they simply cheat. They get the answer sheets and they change answers. So, you know, and what's so heartbreaking about this is that most people who enter the profession of teaching actually have a mission. They want to excite young minds. They want to develop these kids into lifelong learners. And that just gets beaten out of them by a variety of conditions. I mean, you know, it's not great to be teaching in public schools most places in the country these days. It's not an easy job. But the idea that you can offer a material incentive to compensate for the loss of morale is just wrong. And there's no evidence that I'm aware of that it works.
Hmm. So talk then more about that higher purpose piece, whether it be a teacher or a priest or a doctor. I mean, maybe you can work into your job a higher purpose. What about other occupations, you know, a long-haul truck driver or a call center worker?
Right. So I deliberately in the book talk about people who work at the kinds of jobs where you would think it really – it's all about the paycheck. So hospital janitors, the lowest people on the totem pole in hospital settings, and some of them interpret their work and then craft their work, as my colleague Amy Resnewski talks about it, so that they play an integral role in the mission of the hospital, which is to cure disease and ease suffering.
An example of that is what?
They interact with patients to try to cheer them up. They don't clean the visitor's lounge because there's a family there napping because they've been there keeping an all-night vigil. So they don't do their jobs to help the family, a distressed family of a patient, feel better. They help nurses turn large patients so that the patients don't get bed sores. None of this is in their job description. None of this do they get paid for. And my guess is that if a supervisor were watching them closely, the supervisor would probably tell them to stop doing those things. Mm. But that's why they show up for work. Mm. So, you know, they're not janitors in an office building working after everyone has left. They're janitors in a hospital. And the noble purpose of the hospital is something that they internalize. And I think they correctly think that the hospital couldn't function unless they did their jobs well.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about why we work today, why we really work, what we want, need, and only sometimes get from our jobs beyond a paycheck. Here's a scene from NBC's TV show The Office. Jim, played by John Krasinski, and the staff at Dunder Mifflin have formed a search committee to find a new manager. Here, one candidate named Nellie Bertram, played by Catherine Tate, explains her management style.
First, I'll take down the cubicle walls.
But there aren't.
Symbol of transparency. There'd be no titles. Everyone has the same job. Same goes for me. I'd take your job, but I'd reject the title.
A little unspecific.
Everyone would be known for their accomplishments.
That's very interesting. I feel like there might be a conflict there, and if a conflict did arise, how would that be dealt with?
Oh, yeah. Scratch everything from before. I'll tell you what I'd do. Go the other way. More cubicles, more division. Everyone is somebody's boss, and that person can fire the person below them.
That's
and once a month, the lowest performing person, bye-bye.
My guest, Barry Schwarz, is professor of psychology and also professor of social theory and social action at Swarthmore College. His new book is called Why We Work, and his TED Talk about this and about his new book goes live online tomorrow. Barry, you just told us before the break an example where, given the chance, employees make work meaningful and engaging, no added compensation, just a deeper sense of purpose, right?
Yes.
Tell us about the point that you make in the book. It's not only making workers' lives better, but it's good for the bottom line of the company, too. Tell us the story about the Interface Carpet Company.
Sure. So there's a guy named Ray Anderson who was the CEO of a very successful carpet manufacturing company called Interface. And he was getting on in years. He had all the money he could possibly use. And he had this epiphany. I think he read a book about the environment, and it had this epiphany that his mission for the rest of his career should not be to amass more money, but rather to reduce the environmental footprint of the company. It was a terrible polluter. The production process was really bad for the environment. So he embarked on this mission to reduce the environmental footprint to zero so his grandchildren would have a world to live in. He assumed, not unreasonably, that doing this would cost the company money. He didn't care. And it's a 20-year process. They're about two-thirds of the way through. I think they've reduced their environmental footprint by more than 50%. And astonishingly, profits have gone up, not down. And their understanding of this, which was completely unanticipated, is that having this mission so energized the workforce that people worked harder and people worked smarter, and all kinds of great suggestions came from the factory floor about how to make production both more efficient and less polluting. So what happened was, you know, here were people who were basically working for a living, and now you turn the job into a job where they're working to save the planet, working to save the Earth. And it produced this transformative effect. So here's a case where they made money. And a book that I rely on a lot by Jeffrey Pfeffer, who's a management expert at Stanford, makes the same point looking across many, many different industries that what you might call companies that have what you might call enlightened HR policies outperform companies that are lean and, you know, the sort of lean and mean command and control type across industry after industry after industry. And the mystery is that since this is true and it's been true for quite some time, why are employers leaving money on the table by not changing, you know, not changing the nature of the workplace?
Well, help us understand that. Give us more examples of what, quote, an enlightened HR policy might look like.
Well, it's one that actually forces managers to relinquish some control and gives some control, autonomy, and discretion, or a lot of control, autonomy, and discretion to the workforce. It focuses more on what work the employees are doing and less on how they're getting paid for the work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that you can find meaning in the your activities, you the employer, you make that salient and you actually live it. You don't just talk it, but you walk the walk. Mm. And the thing is, that may seem – that last thing, making work meaningful, it may seem like most jobs, there's just no meaning to them. But think about this. There's a deep assumption that undergirds the entire market system, which is that when you engage in a transaction with someone, you're the seller, I'm the buyer, we're both going to leave the transaction better off. Because if I wasn't better off, I wouldn't buy it. And if you weren't better off, that is, you weren't making enough money, you wouldn't sell it. Hmm. So every transaction has to leave the parties better off. And what that means, if that's true, is that no matter how menial your work, when you sell something to somebody, you're making that person's life better.
And here's a great example of that. Thanks for bringing this up, Barry. Here's an example at Toyota. And here's Rick Madrid. He worked at General Motors at the General Motors plant in Fremont, California. Started there in 1955. Toyota took over the plant in 1984, and they instituted new efficiencies into the assembly line. So Rick Madrid was skeptical of the new rules at first until he came across a bolt that was put into a car incorrectly. And here's an interview he gave in 2010 with the public radio program This American Life.
They stopped the line and repaired it, which is take the bolt out, ream the hole, put the bolt back in, instead of sending it on and putting all the other junk on top of it, so you have to take it off and repair it. And whoever puts it back isn't skilled in putting trim back, so they're going to mess up. That impression said, gee, that makes sense. Fix it now so you don't have to go through all this stuff. That's when it dawned on me that we can do it. One bolt. One bolt changed my attitude.
One bolt changed my attitude. There it is, empowering workers instead of sending that car right down the line for somebody else to take care of it, doing it right then and there.
That's a great example, and it's become quite a famous one. The Fremont, California GM plant was widely regarded as the single worst automobile plant in the country, which almost certainly meant that it was the worst one in the world. And Toyota entered this partnership with GM because they wanted to get traction to sell more cars in the United States. And they changed the production process. That is to say, they introduced the Japanese style of production. It wasn't just that it was more efficient. It was more efficient because people worked in teams and the emphasis was on quality, on excellence, and not on productivity. And here's the key. So within a year, this GM plant was performing comparably to the way plants in Japan, Toyota plants in Japan, were performing. But here's the key point. They did not change the workforce. Mm. They just changed the work. Mm. You know, people used to think, well, Japanese workers, they're disciplined, they're better educated, they're this, that, and the other thing. We could never do that in the United States. That's why Japanese car manufacturing was better. Well, here you were. You brought your methods to the United States, and with the very same employees, you turned it into a, quote, Japanese automobile plants. Famous, famous example from 30 years ago.
Didn't change the workforce, just changed the methods, the work.
That's right.
Here's a call, Dylan in Atlanta, Georgia. Dylan, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, go ahead.
So I work for a construction company local here in Atlanta, and it is the most toxic work environment I've ever, you know, I've worked in this industry for quite a number of years, and it's just all around a toxic work environment from middle management up. There's a sense of paranoia, a sense of aggression, hostility in the air. Mm-hmm. We walk, basically, the lower level guys that I work with, we come in every morning on eggshells, walking on eggshells. We don't know if we have a job every day when we come in. We're told, you know, if three jobs needed to get done that day and we got all three jobs, we should have gotten five jobs done that day. Mm. It's never enough. You never hear about it if you've done a great job. You know, I consistently have homeowners tell me, oh, I'm going to call the company and tell them that, you know, you guys did a phenomenal job on my home, and I'll be recommending you guys to my neighbors and so forth, but that never comes back to
us. Never comes back. You never hear it. Dylan, thank you very much for the call, and herein lies the rub, Barry Schwartz. How do you change an environment like that?
I don't know the answer to that because, again, as I said a few minutes ago, you would think, based on the evidence, if that construction company is interested in maximizing profit, the evidence suggests that the way to do it is not by creating a toxic work environment but by creating the opposite. So why are they leaving money on the table? And I just don't know the answer to that. I mean, what I suggest in the book, actually, is that what this reflects is a kind of deep-seated ideology that has been a part of work for at least 200 years, which is the one that started with Adam Smith. People don't want to work. You need to bully them, threaten them, and incentivize them to get them to do anything. And the tougher you are, the leaner and meaner you are, the more they worry that the bottom 20% – this is the Jack Welch rule when he was at General Electric – the bottom 20% lose their jobs no matter how good they are. That's the way to produce an efficient workplace. The evidence suggests that that is not true. Some of the companies succeed despite those practices. Nobody succeeds because of those practices. And why has that been so persistent? I think we have simply drunk the Kool-Aid that this is what work is in the minds of most people who work.
Let me bring another voice in here now, somebody who's made a career out of studying the workplace as well. Michael Beer is an emeritus professor at the Harvard Business School, co-founder and chairman of the Center for Higher Ambition Leadership, and co-founder and director of the management consulting firm TruePoint. He's also the author of Higher Ambition, How Great Leaders Create Economic and Social Value, and High Commitment, High Performance, How to Build a Resilient Organization for Sustained Advantage. He joins me from Kennebunk, Maine. Michael, welcome. Nice to have you.
Nice to be with you.
So you hear Dylan there, our caller, says in a toxic environment with paranoid managers, a lot of aggression. He's walking on eggshells every day. You know, what do you do about a space like that?
Well, first of all, I agree with everything that Barry has been talking about. The evidence is very clear. But what do you do about it? Well, the first thing is you have to start with the managers, the manager of the plant, the CEO of the company. Have to care, have to begin to understand and what the evidence is. But more importantly, it starts with who they are and what they believe about the purpose of a firm. So they can then enable successes in various parts of the organization. They also need internal resources. For example, when I was working at Corning early in my career, we had some managers I'll talk about one manufacturing plant producing medical instruments that called me and said we'd read McGregor's book, The Human Side of Enterprise, which makes many of the same arguments we've been talking about here. So this is not a new idea. And they said we would like to become what McGregor called a Theory Y plant, a plant in which has the assumption that people want to do good work, and all we need to do is enable it. Can you help us figure out how to enable it? With those managers, I can go into the details of that story, but with those managers' desire to do so and some expertise in how to design work differently to provide, as Barry already said, autonomy, broader responsibilities, meaningful work through feedback about the result, whether it's the customer saying, as the gentleman on the phone said, you know, we heard that most of your customers are really satisfied. We think that's great, and so on and so forth. With a number of things, we redesigned the assembly line to enable people to produce the whole instrument. We gave them more responsibility for total quality to make some of those quality decisions that had previously been made by inspectors. We helped supervisors by coaching them to think differently about how they would engage employees around the continual task of moving machines around and redesigning the workspace to make it more efficient. One supervisor came, I went out there and told them what the new place was going to look like, and nobody asked any questions. I said, did you ever ask them what they thought should be done? Well, no, I hadn't. Well, by working with supervisors and training them and getting them some coaching, all that changed. We gave tours to employees of departments that they were not in, that they wanted to find about. And in the process, they discovered all kinds of things. The bolt, if you will, in the car we talked about that needed to be improved. None of this was for extra pay. People got turned on. People were motivated. This was one of the better startups of any plant in the company. This is just a personal example. There are many examples in the 60s and 70s in what was called high commitment plants, in which individual plant managers who became committed to these ideas began to enact them differently, usually with support from the CEO, from somebody in the corporate level.
Somebody at the top. Dylan, thank you so much for calling and bringing up your story. Good luck to you. Here's Dave in Menominee, Michigan. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hi, yes, thank you.
Yes.
I just disagree with I've worked in factories and mills all of my life. I disagree with just about everything both of your guests have been saying.
Okay.
This idea to bring up examples from the 60s and 70s when half of our workforce was unionized, to bring up examples when these guys were making a good pay already to come up with good ideas, that's fine. We don't live in that world anymore. Our jobs have been shipped away. We lost 65,000 factories and mills under the Bush administration. They shipped them away. And when your dad loses his job and the health care for the family, morale goes down. Mm. And when you squeeze all the kids in one school and get rid of all the shop classes, which is what happened under the Bush administration, you don't have the skills growing up to be able to transition into a workforce. That's where we are now.
Got it, Dave. Thank you so much. Barry Schwartz, I'll give you a chance to respond here.
Well, I don't think is anything he said is incorrect. Let me again remind everybody, people need to make a living. And they need to have a job. And when employment is precarious and compensation is inadequate, there's a sense in which nothing else matters. And I think your caller's right that, you know, the death of the union movement has made many people's jobs precarious and inadequately compensated.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the modern workplace this hour and asking, is this the best it could be? Laura Dern plays Amy Jellicoe in the award-winning series on HBO titled Enlightened. Amy is not someone who's well-suited to being a cog in a big machine. She has big ideas of how she could be more purpose-driven in her company. But the human resource department has other ideas. And in this scene, the HR person takes her to her new position with the group of other company misfits to work on a program that tracks other workers' productivity.
You'll be working on a new computer software program called Cogentiva. We're using it to help us chart productivity, employee performance in the warehouses and stores. Amy, this is Doug Daniels.
Yeah, but you can call me Dougie.
Dougie. He's in charge of the Cogentiva program. Yeah,
so I'm like your boss and stuff. Just kidding. No, I am.
And here's another clip from a 1999 movie called Office Space. It's about a group of IT workers who are fed up with their white-collar cubicle jobs. Here, Peter Gibbons, played by Ron Livingston, explains to a hypnotherapist why he hates his job.
So I was sitting in my cubicle today, and I realized ever since I started working, every single day of my life has been worse than the day before it. So that means that every single day that you see me, that's on the worst day of my life.
My guest this hour, Barry Schwartz, professor of psychology, social theory, and social action at Swarthmore College and author of the new book called Why We Work. And Michael Beer, emeritus professor at the Harvard Business School, co-founder and chairman of the Center for Higher Admission Ambition Leadership, and author of High Commitment, High Performance. So many calls here. Let me get to Amy in Greenfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Barry and Michael, if you're still there. Thanks for your work on this, Barry and Michael. And in my experience of working in very diverse workplaces for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, in the private sector, two cooperative organizations, a great business model, and as a contract worker, the common denominator of a high morale workplace, and particularly or a department, is managers who also have emotional intelligence. And I think that that's often hard to come by, someone who's that good at the other aspects of their job, and they're also such a kind of integrated human that they also have, you know, recognize and take, you know, the opportunities to acknowledge and appreciate their staff. Mm. And that makes such an enormous difference in morale and in the bottom line, for sure.
Amy, thank you so much. What about that, Michael Beer, high EQ among managers?
Oh, I completely agree. As I mentioned earlier, you have to have managers and all the way up the line, people who care, who have that emotional intelligence. What I have found is that the companies that really care about creating these kind of workspaces are very careful about the selection of managers. They assess not only the knowledge they have, but who they are as human beings by asking them questions that are not about their grades or about their technical education. It's about how they solve problems in human situations. And also evaluate those managers on those kinds of behavioral characteristics that will support the workers in much the way just described. Mm-hmm. Recognition, providing the resources they need to succeed, and so on and so forth. So absolutely, if you want managers, you need to select them, evaluate them, and promote them based on these kinds of characteristics. And that's what some of the leading firms, those firms that have really thought about this, do. And by the way, your earlier call suggested that the economy, the pressure of outsourcing and so on, and pressures for competitiveness make this impossible or make it more difficult and so forth. And I just want to point out that my colleague Zeynep Tan at MIT, professor at MIT, published a book called The Good Jobs Strategy, in which he identifies retailers who are under complete major pressures for cost, because it's a low-margin business, find a way to provide meaningful work and a living wage at the same time, and are profitable, and more profitable than many of their peers in the same industry. So we can go into more detail about that, but this is possible to do. Many of the companies in the Center for High Ambition Leadership, their CEOs are people who care about all their stakeholders, not just investors, and try to promote these kinds of policies.
Here's Camille in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Hi, Camille. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for my call.
Sure.
So I have a question for your guests. I was wondering, in their research, if you have looked into many worker-owned businesses. I myself am a part owner of a worker-owned restaurant, and I find that I love my job, and a lot of the people that work with me love our job. And I'm just interested in just looking more into that, because I think that if you're looking for people who are happy at their job, if they have a higher investment in what they do and the profit shares that come back to them, I think ultimately it makes the workforce a better, more cooperative place. Mm. And if they have an ability to be the boss, then it makes them more invested.
Camille, thank you. Barry Schwartz, what do you say?
Well, I think that that's an interesting question. I certainly haven't done any – personally haven't done any research, what the caller said is if workers are invested in what they do and the profits – some of the profits come back to them, that's one way in which workers can be invested in what they do. But it's not the only way. You can be invested in what you do because you actually care that whatever you do will have a positive impact on the people you're doing it for. So it's nice if you also get a piece of the profits. But I can also imagine a workplace that has profit sharing but is a draconian command and control environment where if the company does well, you get a bonus at the end of the year. But your day-to-day activity is sort of torture. Mm. So I think it's really important to have an investment in what you do, but we need to have a broader sense of what investment in what you do means or can mean.
Let me bring up the example of the online shoe retailer Zappos, because in April, Zappos got rid of all its managers, replaced them with a system of self-governance called Holacracy. It meant some big changes for the company. Here's Jackie Gonzalez, a customer service worker at Zappos, in an interview with National Public Radio.
We don't have to put someone on hold and ask permission. We don't have a manager that you need to be transferred to. How refreshing is that?
So, Barry Schwartz, the traditional corporate hierarchy is gone. Managers no longer exist. The company's 1,500 employees define their own jobs. Yep. Anybody can set the agenda for a meeting. I mean, to many, that would sound like anarchy. Is it just smart management?
I think it's very smart management. It's ironic, of course, that Zappos is doing this, since Zappos was already unbelievably enlightened. My wife had a couple of experiences with Zappos and couldn't get over how responsive the person on the other end of the phone was and how eager to help solve my wife's problem. So they already were doing it right. I guess they're doing it right. Here's what I think, though. I think people are terrified of the possibility that if you relinquish control in this way, some of the workers will beat you, will take advantage of you. Some slackers will get away with slacking. And so you create a system that guarantees that nobody can get away with anything. And yes, you know, the slackers will be caught and dismissed. But also but the price you're paying is you're diminishing not only the satisfaction but the productivity of everybody else who wouldn't have been a slacker. It's not the worst thing in the world if one or two people take advantage of the discretion and autonomy that you give them. But most managers think it is the worst thing in the world.
Michael Beer, speak to that. Managers threatened by workers who have greater autonomy.
No question. Barry is absolutely right. In my experience, is managers often seek control of the situation because, by the way, they are probably working for a boss that also will get on them if they make a mistake. And so this notion of control is and desire for control is absolutely at the root of some of this. But again, this can be changed. This is the argument I want to make. This can be changed by changing the context in which managers, supervisors, and employees work. And that, in other words, the workplace is a system. You can't have good workers unless you create a system that enables them to feel better and make a contribution. And as I mentioned earlier, this can be done. You can pay a living wage, as these retailers, a Quick Trip, a convenience store, Macedonia, Spain's largest grocery chain, pay very well, pay above the average. At Quick Trip, you can get $40,000 a year for a full-time job to start. That's a convenience store business, by the way. But their workers, yes, they get efficiency by creating standardization, but they also train people to do customer-facing work, logistics tasks. They do not, as somebody earlier in the show said, call in workers at a minute's notice to try to bring them in because they staff up and are able to staff up to create the full-time jobs and give people a good schedule, a meaningful, friendly schedule, and they're able to essentially do very well They promote from within. They ensure their supervisors have the kind of attitude that we've been talking about. They empower people in a really meaningful way.
Here's Ed. Let me get to Ed in Austin, Texas. Michael, thank you. Go ahead. You're on the air, Ed.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
Okay. My comment would be that the problem is not always with the managers. And oftentimes I've found in my business that people are really not motivated because, you know, most of people up and coming just basically push a button and find the answer on their iPhone, and therefore they're kind of programmed, should we say, to want an easy fix about stuff. And at that point, they lose the ability to problem solve, which makes them less employable and less able to advance in the workforce. And I've trained about 6 people. I found that basically one of them really, really was motivated to learn, and I kind of gave it up. I'm self-employed, and I don't have any employees because the manager's job is hard as regards getting people who are really motivated to problem solve in advance and don't kind of want to just push a button.
Ed, thank you. Thank you very much. Here's Trish. That Barry? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to make one comment about that. I'm not saying a manager's job is easy. I think it is hard. But to me, the insight that comment leads to, and something Michael said a few minutes ago did also, is Jeffrey Pfeffer makes this point in his book. He says, you should hire for the characteristics that you don't know how to train and then train the things you do know how to train. We don't know how to train character, curiosity, and eagerness to learn. We do know how to train people to work on spreadsheets. And mostly companies do exactly the opposite. They hire people who, you know, 5 minutes into the job can be productive. And we don't worry about these other things. If you hired people who had the right character, you could teach them the job and you'd end up with much, much better workers. And I think, you know, interest in, willingness to learn, willingness to persevere, these kinds of things, we don't know how to teach that.
Here's Trish in Austin, Texas. Hi, Trish. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
Yes.
I really think it does go back to the system because our system was built in one way that no longer works. And so I really think if you take the working for the corporation and being everything all day long for that corporation and coming home and giving very little to your family, changing that whole idea of putting your family first and making the corporation or the organization work around that, you're going to get, I have 2 different jobs, one I don't make money at that I'm extremely passionate about, which is about that, about putting the family first and about motherhood. And then I have the other job that I go to because I need the benefits and I need to make the money, which if they were, you know, smart, they would get so much more out of me because I even have more to give even after all the passion that I put into my own gig. So my whole thing is this system is broken. Things have changed since the time of, you know, the man goes off to work, his wife is home cooking, and that was really only a short time in history. And it's time to realize where we are, that we have to put our personal lives first, and do everything. I think you'll get so much more out of people when you realize that's going to bring you, as a company and an organization, much more of a benefit financially.
When that's the equation. Trish, thank you so much for the call. About a minute left here, Michael Beer. Have you ever seen instances where the reorganized workplace went terribly wrong?
I am sure that I don't know of one that I can think of at the moment. But I think if it were, I don't know, but I'm sure they exist. But that's because somewhere along the line, somebody violated some of these principles. I will say, for example, back to being invested in the company and having a part of the profitability of the company, there are examples of employee-owned companies where management changed and became very directive, to Barry's earlier point. And even though the employees owned the company, they were completely controlled. Well, that's where it goes completely wrong. Mm-hmm. And they don't get any benefits at all from that particular practice, which is a good practice. In fact, many of the high commitment companies I studied have profit sharing plans all the way and stock options sharing plans all the way down the line in the organization.
So, Barry Schwartz, you get the last word here. Fulfillment, challenge, meaningful work, autonomy, help employees get that, and the bottom line grows for the employer. Is that right?
That's right. Now, I think these are worthwhile even if the bottom line doesn't grow, because I think it's a kind of a crime against humanity that half of our waking lives spent doing things, as you put it before, things we'd rather not do in places we'd rather not be. So even if it was neutral, revenue neutral, I'd think we'd want to transform the workplace. But as it turns out, it isn't. It actually makes the company a better company.
Michael Beer, co-founder and chairman of the Center for Higher Ambition Leadership, emeritus professor at the Harvard Business School. Thank you for your time in this holiday, Michael. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
And big thanks to you, Barry Schwartz, author of the new book, Why We Work, professor of social theory and social action at Swarthmore College, coming into a TED Talk tomorrow. Barry, thank you very much for this work.
Thank you so much, Jane.
And to those laboring on this Labor Day, happy Labor Day. You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.